irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to The Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I want to welcome you to the post-diet revolution. That means no more dieting, no more counting calories or carbs, no more thinking about food all the time. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health, all without ever going on another diet. We're not going to talk about what you're eating. We're going to talk about why. If you want to join me today, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. I would love to hear what's on your mind because, remember, it's not what you're eating that's the real problem, although it may seem like it. It's what's eating at you. It's what's weighing on you. And when we identify and work through those root issues and conflicts, you will make peace with food for good. So I want to share my most popular Instagram post because I think you guys will like it. If you've already seen it on Instagram, doesn't hurt to hear it again. So it's actually what I posted today, a quote, "A lion never loses sleep over the opinion of sheep." Don't you love that? A lion never loses sleep over the opinion of sheep. Now, I know that I saw this on Game of Thrones, but it dates way back. And it's a really great quote because so many people worry about what other people will think of them. They stop themselves from taking action. They stop themselves from doing what they want because they are worried about what other people will think of them if they follow their hearts. Will others judge them as weird, arrogant, selfish, different? Will they reject them? Well, here's the thing. There are people out there who absolutely will judge you. Maybe because they're envious. They've got to tear you down and make themselves feel better. Maybe they reject people who are different from them with differing values or ideas. Maybe because judging others makes them feel better about themselves. Whatever with them, right? Those are sheep. You want to be a lion and stay firm in the courage of your convictions. Don't let other people have so much power over the choices you make in your life. Remember, it is your life. You can live it as you please. So learn to listen to that inner voice that knows what's truly right for you. Trust that inner lion and let yourself roar. Let yourself truly live. Because if you don't, you might turn to coping strategies like binging or other forms of coping that end up hurting more than they help. There is another way. And that is to listen to yourself and not live your life by dodging what other people might think or do. After all, to quote another quote, life is not a dress rehearsal. So carpe diem, seize the day. Okay, so last week I talked about my food mood formula, and I started telling you guys about the correlation between smooth, creamy foods and the need for comfort. And today, we're going to talk about another category in this food mood formula, and that is crunchy. Now, back in the 80s, Lay's potato chips had this commercial, and basically, the commercial was like, "Bet you can't eat just one." And that is for sure. Everyone knows what it feels like to pick up a bag of chips, intending to have just a few, and before you know it, boom, the whole bag is gone. How did that happen? So if you think the explanation for the "you can't just eat one" is you lack willpower, think again. The reason or the actually the reasons you can't eat just one chip has to do with both science and psychology. So a few years ago, a study in the New England Journal of Medicine followed over 120,000 men and women for 30 years. 120,877 to be precise. Men and women, they followed them for 30 years. And the participants in the study who gained the most weight were the ones who overate potato chips. So what is it about chips that makes them so irresistible? Potato chips, tortilla chips, all of these kinds of snacky foods are high in fat and carbs. And this ratio of high fat and carbs makes them, you know, super delicious and irresistible. Scientists call these foods hyperpalatable. And these kinds of snacks rate high on what is known by scientists as the hedonic scale of pleasurable foods. You would think that they would come up with some some less clunky language. But when it comes to food and eating behavior, the term hedonic refers to eating that is motivated by enjoyment rather than hunger. Enjoyment and rather than emotional eating, we'll get to that later. So we can't resist chips because the combination of fat and carbs lights up the reward centers of our brains and makes us want more instantly. Now, of course, not every snack has to be eaten as a response to hunger, but if you regularly find that you cannot stop eating chips or other crunchy snack foods, it doesn't have to do with willpower. The culprit may actually be in your stomach. Now, we usually associate taste buds with our mouths, but did you know you can also have taste receptors in your stomach and in your small intestines? The taste buds on our tongues are actually associated with the part of our brains that perceive taste, but the taste buds in our stomach activate the part of our brains that tell us we're full. Pretty interesting, right? So our taste receptors in our gut register we have food in our stomach, which signals our brains to increase the production of hormones that help us process that food. And that in turn helps us realize when we've had enough to eat. So one of these hormones is called ghrelin, G-H-R-E-L-I-N. I think it's ghrelin. It's known as the hunger hormone. It's an appetite stimulant that slows our metabolism, it inhibits fat burning, and it promotes fat storage. Ooh. So in our early days as humans, hey, this hormone was essential to our survival. It kept us from starving ourselves to death. Now, here's what's interesting. Dieting causes a rise in this hunger hormone, ghrelin. The more weight you lose, the higher your levels of ghrelin. That's because your body doesn't know you're trying to lose weight to fit into a new outfit or, you know, feel better or be able to run a marathon or something. Your body is simply doing what it is designed to do, which is to protect you from starving. Another reason why dieting bad. Another hormone related to appetite is leptin, which regulates appetite and food intake as well. So when we have high levels of leptin, our brains get a signal that we're full and we stop eating. Lower levels of leptin make us feel hungrier and make it difficult for us to know when we're full and satisfied. You know, some people come to me and they say, well, I can never get full. I can never, ever, I can't find full. Now, sometimes that may have to do with psychology. Again, we'll get to that later. But sometimes it has to do with hormones. And also, leptin levels decrease after short-term fasting, which is another reason why dieting or calorie restriction is a bad idea. Chronic sleep deprivation is associated with lower levels of leptin and higher levels of ghrelin. So one strategy to stop eating too many chips, pretzels, or crunchy, salty snacks is to get more sleep. How about that? Another ingredient in chips and those kinds of snacks makes it difficult to control our intake. So what is this mystery culprit? Can you guess? Salt. That's right. Good old salt, a natural mineral made out of two elements, sodium and chlorine. salt consumption has been linked to obesity. Now, one reason is dehydration. We often think we're hungry when we're actually thirsty. So the next time you feel a craving for salty foods, you may actually just need a drink of water. Now, why is this? Because if you get dehydrated, the levels of fluid in your body gets too low, your body starts craving salt because that's nature's way of making you drink more fluids. So the next time you reach for a salty bag of chips, try having a cold glass of water or room temperature if that's your thing. I prefer room temperature. Most people seem to prefer cold. Try having a glass of water, whatever temperature you like, and see what happens. That urge for salty chips just may disappear. And if it doesn't, try a healthier alternative, like roasted seaweed, which if you haven't had roasted seaweed, it might sound kind of nasty, but it's actually pretty good. It's low calorie. It's loaded with health benefits. It's rich in iodine. It's a good source of B12 and potassium. And, you know, it's pretty good. Another link between salty snacks is calcium deficiency. So women on low calcium diets often have a craving for salty foods. So if there is indeed a correlation between calcium deficiency and salt cravings, which lead to chips, eating foods high in calcium, yogurt, almonds, tofu, sardines, that may help reduce your cravings for salty snacks. Let's see. So another reason why potato chips feel so addictive has to do with the way they sound. Do you ever notice how often commercials for chips and stuff promote crunchiness? Or look at the advertising on the bag. Like the next time you're at a grocery store, look at the advertising. It's always like super crunchy, extra crunchy. That's because we have positive associations to food that are a specific level of crispness. So think about the last time you bit into a stale chip. Oof. Yuck. Right? When that crunch is gone, that chip is not so appealing. In fact, a few decades ago, this is so important that a few decades ago, potato chip companies developed a machine to measure the level of crunch that consumers hear in their heads while eating chips. And they discovered this optimal level of crunch, and they made their chips to match those levels of crunchiness. And, you know, for some reason, like, we crave crunchy. So the crunchy sound is scientifically part of their appeal. And that goes back 60 million years or so. When humans were evolving from other primates, they ate a lot of insects. The crispier the insect, the more nutrition it provided. Crazy, huh? I mean, it's so cool how here we are in 2018 and so much of our behavior and our instincts are still so primal and go back so far. So, you know, nowadays we judge foods like apples or celery or lettuce by how crunchy they are. I don't know about lettuce. Oh, I guess. The louder the crunch, the more vitamins and nutrients there are. So, you know, potato chips are certainly not chock full of either vitamins or nutrients. It's really about the fat. Like I said, our brains are better at detecting the fat in our foods than our mouths because it goes from the gut to the brain, our taste receptors. Noisy chips are full of fat. So, crunchy foods are correlated with freshness, and we are sort of hardwired, or so to speak, not that we're robots, but we're genetically wired to seek the familiar. Crunchy is good. There's a gastrophysicist and professor of experimental psychology named Charles Spence, and he says, sound is the forgotten flavor sense. You tell a lot about the texture of a food. Think crispy, crunchy, crackly, from the sounds that you hear while you're biting and chewing. And the latest techniques from the field of cognitive neuroscience are revolutionizing our understanding, he says, of just how important what we hear is to our experience and enjoyment of food and drink. And he and his colleagues conclude that sound as well as taste is part of the appeal of potato chips. One last sort of neuroscientific thing. You may be drawn to salty, crunchy food if you're eating way too many soft, smooth foods. If you're living on smoothies and yogurt and soup, you may need to change things up a bit and add variety or textures to your diet. Because when you've been eating too many soft, mushy foods, your salivary glands and the muscles in your jaw kind of get bored. And that's when you start craving crunchy foods. So there are a lot of neuroscientific reasons for why you can't stop eating potato chips. And of course, no question, our physiology influences our food choices. Yet, our brains and our gastrointestinal tracts are only part of the story. Our brains are the control center of our bodies. But we also have minds. We have minds, and that influences our thoughts, our beliefs, our feelings, our behavior. And that's why it's important to look at the psychology of crunchy foods. So a connection does exist between experiencing certain negative emotions, especially anger, and reaching for salty, crunchy foods like potato chips. So hold that thought. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Hi, Dr. Nina. Brian from Chicago. How are you?
Hi, Brian from Chicago. Good to hear from you. How are you?
You too. I'm doing well. So I had a question that just kind of popped up in my mind just because of listening to you over the weeks, and it's something I've heard you talk about from time to time, and it never really occurred to me to ask you to kind of clarify what it means. So here you go. When you talk about this food mood connection that you have spoken about pretty frequently, are you talking about like every time you eat, or you know, anytime randomly there's a food mood connection, or is that really only referencing when there's something really kind of emotionally heightened or painful or powerful going on that there's a connection?
What? I think your question is actually the answer, because there's nothing inherent. The second part of your question is actually the answer. It's a great question, because not every time when we want ice cream does that mean we need comfort. So, you know, if we've gone out to dinner, or we're at dinner, or we've had dinner and we were like, oh, I feel like some ice cream for dessert, that is very different from saying, oh, I feel bad, I feel depressed, I'm bummed about my breakup, I have to have some ice cream now, right? So when I'm talking about this food mood formula, it's when you're using food to resolve some kind of inner pain or conflict or upset feeling.
Okay.
Same with...
Yeah, that was my question. Like, you know, every time I eat something crunchy or sweet or whatever it is, should I be stopping to go, I wonder how I'm really feeling?
Well, that's not a bad idea, you know, just to do. And you, the answer might be, oh, no, I'm just having some, I've had too many mushy foods and now I need something crunchy. My salivary glands are bored. It doesn't hurt to ask yourself that, but you know, it's really when you're using food to change the way you feel that this formula most applies. So, you know, and when you overeat it, it's like when you can't stop eating it, you can't stop eating ice cream. You just inhale a bag of chips. That's more than just eating a portion. Then when you can't stop, that's when you want to look at, okay, what is it that I'm trying to resolve? What do I really need right now? What am I trying to express?
Okay. So if you can kind of feel a sense of, you know, I'm eating in a way that seems kind of outside my norm, and it seems to be fueled by something, I feel like I'm eating, but I also feel like a little anxious or a little weird, maybe it makes some sense to just put the food down for just a second and say, okay, where am I at right now?
Right. What's eating at me? And then to remember, all right, the food and mood formula, right? Okay, I can't stop eating this Ben and Jerry's. That means I must need comfort in some way. And then, you know, cultivate a way to comfort yourself. And, you know, I can certainly talk about that too, because when you're so used to using food to resolve anything uncomfortable, you don't develop a way to comfort yourself with language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or, I'm eating this, I'm inhaling this chip, these chips. That means I must be angry. Mm-hmm. How else can I express my anger?
Right. Go find a punching bag or something.
That's a great way to get rid of the physical sort of experience of anger, all of that adrenaline and all that built up anger. But you also need, in addition to just punching a punching bag, you need to express why you're angry. Not necessarily to the person who's making you angry. You know, again, you're not going to, if you're mad at your boss, you're not going to be like, you're pissing me off, dude. That's not going to help.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tell a friend or tell yourself or write it out or find some way to use, because you have to express it. Also, you know, what does it mean? What does it mean? What's making you angry? What's happening? What's going on in you? Not just the feeling of anger. There's something that's triggered that. There's some meaning, and expressing that has to be part of the picture.
Okay, totally helpful. Thank you for answering that. I was wondering about it.
So, anything upsetting you? Here's your chance. Unburden yourself, Brian. Anything making you mad?
I'm actually fine. I'm good. I'm not feeling anything particularly acutely painful or anxiety producing. I'm fine, but thanks for asking.
Okay, well, thanks for asking a good question. I always appreciate your thoughtful questions and happy to answer them. And because if you're thinking it, you know, people out there are thinking it too.
Well, hopefully they know that there really is very few more pleasant experiences in terms of dealing with feelings than being able to call you like this and talk to you. So I hope everybody takes advantage of that.
Thank you, Brian. I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Aw. Brian from Chicago. Yeah, that was a great question, because and I think it always helps to check in with yourself, even if you're having dessert. What's motivating me to want this dessert? Is it to resolve something psychological? Is it to make me feel better? Or is it just, you know what? It's dessert. And the more that you check in with yourself, the better able you'll be to discern that. So, okay. So there is an emerging field called psychophysiology. Psychophysiology. It refers to the study of the relationship between physiological processes in your body and psychological behavior. So researchers in this field of study, psychophysiology, it's just kind of fun to say, psychophysiology. So the psychophysiologists, okay, I'll stop. They look at the ways in which the mind and body interact. So from their perspective, chewing and crunching, right? Chewing hard and crunching are natural outlets for inborn aggression. Now, Dr. Alan Hirsch, who is a neurologist and psychiatrist, how about that for being an overachiever? He founded the Smell and Taste Treatment and Research Foundation in Chicago. Hey, Brian from Chicago, check out the Smell and Taste Treatment and Research Foundation. Anyway, he notes the connection between crunchiness and aggression. He says, when you bite into ice or potato chips, you're sublimating your anger in a healthy way. Now, sublimation is a defense mechanism in which you might find something very socially unacceptable, like expressing anger, and you transform it into a socially acceptable behavior. So imagine, let's take my example, that I just said to Brian. You're angry at your boss for, you know, being upset at you over some minor situation, instead of speaking up for yourself in a biting tone to your boss, which might not go over so well. Instead of that, you chow down, you bite down on a bag of tortilla chips, right? You get out your aggression. Dr. Hirsch has also studied the connection between personality and food cravings. This is interesting. I'm not sure I totally agree, but hey, he's the expert. He finds that people who love potato chips are competitive. He says they're ambitious and enjoy rewards in both business and pleasure. He also finds that chip lovers are easily frustrated, which is a form of anger, at life's inconveniences, such as rush hour traffic or long lines at the checkout. He said whether they're at Disneyland, the DMV, or behind the wheel, they tend to always be in a rush. Well, you know, sorry, Dr. Hirsch, but who doesn't feel that way? Like, is there someone out there who's really going to say, oh, yes, I'm waiting for 45 minutes to get on the Matterhorn, but that's okay. Or I'm at the DMV, but I'm not in a rush. I could just be here all day. Or in traffic. But okay, that's associated with chips. A second personality characteristic that is common to people who like crunchy foods is perfectionism. Now, this may not be such a bad thing, since perfectionists are focused and energetic. They're also punctual. They're excited by challenges. Pretzel lovers, he said, are often the life of the party, displaying the characteristics of being lively, enthusiastic, and fun. Now, early in our lives, biting is a common way of expressing aggression. Babies and toddlers often feel frustrated or angry, but they lack the language to express themselves. I remember my younger daughter, when she moved up from like at Montessori, she moved up from like baby class to not class, yeah, class, baby class to like young toddler. And all of a sudden, you know, she went from being with 1.5-year-olds to being with, you know, 2-year-olds, 2.5-year-olds, and she didn't talk yet. She's 1.5, and she had never been a biter, but all of a sudden she started biting everyone like she was a puppy. And that was the way that she was expressing how, you know, upset she was about this change. And it makes sense, right? The solution is to chomp down as a way of saying, I'm upset. Although we eventually learn to talk about how we feel and to communicate in words, hopefully we do, biting is associated with aggression throughout our lives. And by the way, she was not the only biting baby. There was like a whole thing with biting babies. They were all, every time they moved up, they would bite just for like a week. So think of the language we use to describe someone who's upset. So, you know, we'll be like, oh, they really bit my head off. We might describe aggression as biting and harsh. Someone who is holding back anger might be described as having a clenched jaw, right? So you can see how biting and aggression are so completely linked. Keith Cantor, Cantor with a K, he is a nutritionist and researcher, and he has looked into the connection between personality and food choices, much as the other researcher. Now, his findings indicate that people who are drawn to salty foods are competitive and worthy adversaries. So, sort of same characteristics. He says they're ambitious and enjoy rewards in both business and pleasure. And one last person, Dr. Chen, I'm not even going to try to pronounce his first name because I know I will butcher it. Dr. Chen, he's a Chinese scientist. His area of expertise is in the study of food physics, oral physiology, and psychophysics, right? Psychophysics examines the relationship between the physical stimuli in our lives and the resulting sensations and mental states. And he says that human beings have a sort of a genetic destructive nature. He says humans have a strange way of releasing stress by punching, kicking, smashing, or other forms of destructive actions. Eating is one of them. The action of teeth crushing food is a destructive process, and we receive pleasure from that or become de-stressed. So people who swallow their anger feel they can't express it, so they resort to food often. Of course, you don't really enjoy what you're eating when you're stuffing hostile feelings. And that's one thing I think people do not understand about binge eating. Said it is often not enjoyable, or maybe it is for a bit, and then it becomes horrible and painful and awful. So remember that if you have a situation in which you cannot stop eating, or you feel like you are completely out of control, there is some underlying reason for your behavior that you may not understand, but it is driving it. And the reason I created the food mood formula, smooth and creamy equals need for comfort, salt, crunchy is anger, the third one is filling bulky foods, which are associated with loneliness and filling a void, and I'm adding a fourth to my food mood formula, and that's chocolate, associated with a need for sweetness in your life. We'll get to that another day. So let me give you an example. So one of my patients, let's call her Beth. Beth was preoccupied with losing the 20 pounds she had gained over the last year. Ever since her youngest daughter had gone away to college, Beth could not stop eating Doritos. And she did not understand why she didn't have more willpower. She's like, I'm blessed in my life. Her husband, Brian, she's not from Chicago, it's a different Brian. Her husband and she were in great shape financially. Their kids were healthy and happy. She said, what's my problem? Why can't I stop eating chips? Now, Beth had struggled with her weight on and off for most of her adult life, and she was at her lowest weight when she married Brian, who was her college boyfriend. And after he finished med school, she stayed home to raise their three daughters while Brian built a successful plastic surgery practice. And her weight was stable throughout the years she was bringing up her girls, and she loved being a stay-at-home mom. Now that she was an empty nester, she did not know what to do with herself. And she told me she ate perfectly, that was her word, perfectly all day. A bowl of bran cereal with non-fat milk for breakfast, carrots or string cheese at midday, a salad with some kind of protein at lunch, and a healthy dinner of either fish, chicken, or vegetables. It was only at night after dinner that she found herself wandering into the kitchen looking for something to eat and always losing control. She told me that she was so good all day. She said, why do I mess it up at night? I'm not even hungry. What's my problem? What's wrong with me? Well, during those nighttime excursions to the kitchen, she usually ate potato chips or popcorn. And she was really ashamed of the fact that she often had an entire family-sized bag of chips in one sitting, like almost every night. And she tried to find at first like a physical reason for her cravings. She's like, I wonder if I just have a thing for salt. I never go for anything sweet, she told me. She's like, you could put a bowl of ice cream in front of me. I wouldn't be tempted in the least. But I told her that her choice of chips might give us a clue about what was going on with her emotionally, what was eating at her. So when I suggested the connection between chips and anger, Beth was, shall we say, skeptical. She did not think her overeating chips was linked with angry feelings. Although she was willing, she was open-minded, she was willing to consider it as a possibility. And at her next session, she said, hey, you know, her husband had texted that he was running late, even later than usual. And she, you know, she understood that he's busy, he's got a lot of demands on his time, and it's always been that way ever since he was in med school. But she noticed that right after she heard from her husband, She went to the kitchen for chips. I said, sounds like you had some feelings about his lateness. She's like, no, that's part of the deal. It's part of being a doctor's wife. Even when the girls were little, Brian was never home before 7 or 8 o'clock at night. She said, that's how it's always been. That's how it is. And she can't do anything about it. That's how it is. So I told her, you know, just because you know something or you can't change a situation, that doesn't mean you can't have feelings about it. Like, you can know something and still have feelings about it. For example, that's why we mourn, right? We don't mourn the loss of death. We don't mourn the loss of a loved one to change the situation. We mourn it so that we can feel better about the loss. So it's not about changing a situation. So Beth was like, thought that she should be able to make herself feel differently about things if she knew that there was nothing she could do. She's like logic should somehow inform her feelings. And logic does not change what you feel. You cannot talk yourself out of or into feelings. It's impossible to tell yourself not to feel upset and then immediately feel differently. It's impossible to positive think yourself out of feeling bad about something. First, you've got to recognize that you feel bad. Then you can use the positive thinking. So I told her, my favorite line, it's not logical, it's psychological. My favorite line about logic. And she really struggled with this concept because she'd always felt like a failure for not doing or feeling what she knew logically, intellectually, rationally was best for her. And I was offering her this new paradigm that was really difficult for her to wrap her head around. Like, she got it, but she couldn't imagine feeling that way. She couldn't imagine responding to her that way. So she was using chips to channel her anger, and she was, you know, crunching violently as a way of expressing her feelings, and then later getting mad at herself for eating too much and gaining weight. And the anger she could not allow herself to recognize that she had towards her husband and other situations in her life was still being expressed. She consciously denied it and then unconsciously expressed it towards herself. So she spent years denying what she really felt, and then she turned against herself by attacking her weight or eating the wrong thing, always mad at herself. So in our work together, she slowly got in touch with her anger towards her husband, and she finally admitted to herself how much she resented him for prioritizing work over spending time with the family. So while she was raising the girls, she'd been so busy with their activities, she didn't let herself even think about how often he was gone. And now that the girls were grown and out of the house, she was alone in an empty house, and food, specifically chips, served as a distraction from her feelings. And so, as you can see, underlying Beth's problem with chips was a problem in her marriage. And once she became curious, not critical, once she became curious about what was going on with her, instead of critical of herself and what she was eating, she was able to address the problems in her marriage. And when she did that, guess what? She stopped eating chips. So a lot of people tell me, oh, I can't be angry. It's that I can't do that to somebody else. I'm not an angry person. Anger is bad. You know, anger is not bad. It may feel bad. May feel good. Anger is simply a reaction to a situation. Any feeling. Okay, hold that thought again. Hi, caller. You're on with Dr. Nina.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Nina. This is Larry. How is your morning going?
My morning is going well, thank you. What about yours?
Pretty good. Getting some work done and able to get dialed in. So far, so good.
Well, it's good to hear from you.
Say again, sorry.
It's good to hear from you.
I may have a bad connection. Getting coffee can syndrome. I'll keep trying. I heard you talking about the food feeling thing going on with chips and crunching and sweetness and all of that, and it reminded me about the mind-body connection in general, which I've always found fascinating.
Yes.
Oops. Still there?
I'm here. I can hear you perfectly.
Okay. You know, from my own experience, I remember as a little kid having high blood pressure just through the roof. And looking back on it, I know it had to have been, some of it had to have been anger, a lot of repressed anger, even as a 10-year-old. And then I have a sister who is a, probably has about 10 to 20 diseases at any given moment, but she does not want to look at her history or her psychology. And I can see clearly that that's mind-body related too. So I've always been fascinated with that. And while you were talking, I looked up cancer-prone personality types. And, you know, I beat cancer about 5 years ago, and I can run these by. It's kind of interesting.
Yes, I'm very interested to hear that.
Okay. Represses negative emotions. Shows anger, resentment, or hostility toward others, reacts adversely to and does not cope well with life changes, is negative or pessimistic, becomes easily depressed or has feelings of hopelessness, and feels the need for approval and to please others. I think I'm like 5 for 5 or 6 for 6, and I'm not judging that, but I think that there's genetics and there's physical environment, but it's so interesting how studies have shown that people who get cancer, who have abnormal cellular growth, seems to be highly correlated with these things.
You know, that may be, but there are also many people with those characteristics who don't get cancer. But it is interesting, but I absolutely, there is a mind-body connection. I've had I once had a patient who was going to get back surgery because she had unbearable back pain and couldn't work, terrible back pain, and I suspected, and she had been to so many doctors, and she was told by one that she needed surgery on her spine, and it was going to be this huge, massive operation. And I told her that maybe she could get her operation if we worked together for 6 months and she didn't feel better, she should think about the operation, but give it 6 months, because I really believed that her back pain was an expression of the burden she felt in her life. And
yeah, speaking of back pain, my elderly mom has spinal stenosis, and when she's around me, it's horrible. When my brother stops by, it goes away. When she drives around with him, it's okay. When she goes to the hospital with Uber, it's okay. It's horrible when she is with me, and then when she sees a medical professional, she feels better, smiling, laughing, and it depends on her mood. One time, she had horrible back pain, and I wasn't trying to trick her. I said, yeah, you feel like going to Denny. She said, that's fantastic. Within 15 seconds, she said, my back feels so much better.
Mm.
It's funny how that works. And
conversion.
All of it reminds me of a book that I honestly haven't read, but I've read enough of it to, if you don't mind me recommending it, maybe you've heard of it. But it's called The Biology of Belief. Mm. And I actually had someone who's majoring in psychobiology at UCLA. I mentioned that, and she said, wow, I want to read that. So she did. So I'm recommending it by proxy, and I'll read it one of these days. But I know the book deconstructs the body at the cellular level, and then shows how the mind and the emotions affect the body at that level, from, I think, quantum physics and even spirituality. And once those cells learn something from those emotions and thoughts, it affects the whole body. It's just
It is amazing. It actually goes back. Freud studied this at his time. Remember, he is in the end of the Victorian era. And there was this, at that time, there was a very prevalent syndrome among young women called glove paralysis, in which one of their arms would become completely paralyzed from elbow to fingertips. And it was whatever, if they were right-handed, it was the right hand. If they were left-handed, it was the left hand. And it was one, not both, usually. And he discovered that this was, at that time, they called it hysterical conversion, that the there was such a prohibition against masturbation in the Victorian era that if women were paralyzed, they couldn't do it. And so it was an outgrowth of the Victorian puritanical values and the prohibition against masturbation of women that caused this glove paralysis. Now, we don't really have glove paralysis anymore because we live in a very different society. But that is an example of how powerful the mind can be with the body. The body can express what the mind cannot.
It's I know my mom, it's always back to her painting Dr. Freud, but she has expressed anger through food, offering me food. I've shared this before with you on the air.
Yes.
That's obvious. As you were talking, it reminds me when I was about 21, I had my wisdom teeth pulled by a guy in the valley named Dr. Smiler. I'm not making that up. That's a side note. But he didn't numb the area before injecting it. And I heard that oral surgeons are a little more assertive, shall we say, with needles. It hurt like hell. I screamed. And he said, oh, sorry about that. Then he went to the next tooth, and it hurt like hell again, and I screamed. And he said, hold on, I haven't injected you yet. I was expecting that, and it, you know, it came out of my noggin. So even something as basic as that, it's really, you know, not a mind-body connection, but they are one. The two of them are one.
Yes. And often people who are always hungry, now it may have something to do with those hunger hormones, or hunger is also an expression of yearning, of wanting more. And so when in our lives we are unfulfilled, even look at the language, when we're unfulfilled, we might find ourselves constantly physiologically hungry as a way of expressing our need for more, for some kind of fulfillment. It becomes about our bodies, not our lives.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the phrase "swallow your anger" isn't by accident, or maybe bulimics expel their anger. I know, most of the time I have my third bowl of ice cream. It's not that I'm hungry.
Probably not the second bowl either. So don't have a vocabulary or a stance with yourself that is comforting and kind and responsive, ice cream is going to be a replacement.
Yeah.
But when you
it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, when you can truly cultivate a true, not just an intellectual care for yourself, but a true self-care, self-love, self-acceptance. Self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. And want the best for yourself, it's going to be a lot easier to be comforting.
It's sort of become, it is a habit. I know that I used to believe that the whole idea of processing what I understand, I used to think it was about some, you know, epiphany where I collapse and I see the light and the angels sing in the clouds part.
The Oprah aha moment.
Maybe with or without rainbows, it just depends. But my understanding now, I think you might have mentioned it on your show earlier, is that every time I am curious, not critical, and all of that, and I recognize why am I doing this, and I stop and breathe and say, I don't need this, I will do this instead, and then I don't white knuckle, that alone is processing, thereby creating the habit.
Yeah, that's right. And creating new neuropathways, as a scientist would say. Yes, and it comes from relinquishing an old stance with yourself that may be identification with cruel parents, and it may be whatever reason. It means creating a warmth and tenderness and kindness towards yourself that really comes from your heart, not your head. Because when you feel that, you want to take good care of yourself. Eating three bowls of ice cream is like self-abandonment. But when you want to, when you can take care of yourself and you really truly want to, on a just on every level, it's a lot easier.
Yeah, and you know, you're talking about neural connections. I wonder, even from a psychodynamic standpoint, if a kid who's abused, even just emotionally growing up, has those neural connections while their brain is developing, if that stunts the emotional ability to care for oneself beyond Freudian stuff, which I think is important, but actual physiological stunting from that abuse.
Well, we are out of time. However, But I'm going to answer it not next week because I have a guest, but I'll answer it in 2 weeks. But actually, neuroscience is actually proving some of Freud's developmental theories to be correct. It's corroborating it. Absolutely. The short answer is yes, but I'll talk more about it in 2 weeks. So
sounds good.
Thank you for another excellent question and for joining me on the show today.
Okay. Talk to you in 1 week. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Larry. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
And that is our show for today. Thank you all so much for joining me on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. I am so glad to spend this hour with you. And if you would like more food for thought, inspiration, information, check out my website, winthedietwar.com, and follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at WinTheDietWar. I'll see you next week.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.